Jonathan Capehart in today for Leonard Lopate. When President-elect Donald Trump chose Andrew Puzder, chief executive of the company that franchises the fast food outlets Hardee's and Carl's Jr., to be Secretary of Labor, he praised Puzder as someone who has, quote, created and boosted the careers of thousands of Americans. But Puzder is an outspoken critic of both minimum wage increases and the worker protections enacted by the Obama administration. Over the past few months, fast food workers joined Uber drivers and other low-wage workers in 24 cities across the country demanding widespread minimum wage increases to $15 an hour. At the start of the new year, 19 states raised the minimum wage, increasing the pay of millions of workers. New York Times labor and workplace reporter Noam Scheiber joins us to talk about labor rights in the Trump era and give us an update on the nationwide Fight for 15 movement, and I'm pleased to welcome him to the show today. Welcome to the show, Noam.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
So, do we know why President-elect Trump chose Puzder to be Secretary of Labor? What qualifies him for this position?
Well, it's interesting. I think there's been a narrative out there that as you watch Donald Trump fill out his cabinet, that he's got a couple of core issues that he's very interested in, trade being one of them. And really beyond those core issues, it's kind of we're just watching the Republican establishment file in and people kind of getting slotted into roles where Donald Trump doesn't have very strong preferences. I think that's not exactly true with Puzder and labor. I think if you actually look at Puzder's background, he and Donald Trump have a lot in common. They both, have a very strong kind of ethic of believe in this ethic of the entrepreneur. They're businessmen. They think that there is kind of no higher calling in the world than running a very profitable company. So I think they do see the world in similar terms. And I think if you kind of unpack the worldview, at least as it relates to workers, I think what you see is essentially this idea that if you are working for a salary, or for a wage for a living, if you're not kind of off on your own running your own business, then, you kind of have to have limited expectations about how good you're going to do in life. Mm-hmm. Implicit is this idea that, these kind of minimum wage jobs and low wage jobs, they're not great jobs. They're not cushy, but they're not intended to be cushy. And if you're struggling in such a job, then the answer is go off on your own and start a company. Take some risks, roll up your sleeves, try to become an entrepreneur, or move up to management. And so I think there's this view that labor, at least at the very low end, is in some sense a commodity. This idea that you would make it a kind of long-term proposition, mm-hmm. Is just not, is just kind of missing the point. And if you really want some security, and if you really want, kind of a more rewarding job, then you sort of set off on your own, And so I think that's why that's why the view that we hear from Puzder on some of these regulations, on some of these protections, it's not him kind of being cold-hearted per se. It's just a sort of different conception of what these jobs entail.
Well, I mean, so given everything that you just said, how is that going to mesh with his job as, assuming he's confirmed, job as labor secretary? What are the tasks? What does the labor secretary actually do?
Yeah, it's a great question. Many of us are wondering. The labor secretary does a variety of things, but one of the most important things I think that many advocates and veterans of the Labor Department would say is enforce a variety of regulations. I mean, we have very strong, well-established laws governing employment in the workplace. Overtime laws, minimum wage laws. Laws about health and safety. And so there is a very strong enforcement component to what the Labor Secretary and the Labor Department does. And the Labor Department under President Obama, particularly in his second term, under Tom Perez, the Labor Secretary, the current Labor Secretary, has been pretty aggressive, you know. And I think one thing to keep in mind about the Labor Department and its enforcement responsibilities is it does not have enough enforcement officers or enforcement capacity to sort of constantly audit and monitor every employer. So what it does is it gets involved in certain, you know, high-profile cases that can kind of set norms, established norms across industries. And this Labor Department has been aggressive about doing that, particularly in the fast food sector. The person who's the administrator of the wage and hour division that enforces minimum wage and overtime is a guy named David Weil, a former professor at Boston University, who's written extensively about this stuff and has very strong feelings about the way that workers are treated in the fast food industry. So they've been very aggressive at it. And again, it's not like they can kind of come down hard on every employer out there who may be violating the law, but they can certainly symbolically convey the message that they are taking this very seriously. And so I think there's a very powerful signaling effect that the Labor Secretary has. And I think the concern is that PUSDR would signal sharp change in direction from Paris when it comes to these things.
I'm speaking with New York Times labor reporter Noam Scheiber, getting an update here on labor and the fight for 15 in the Trump era. President Obama will be president for a couple of weeks. So let's talk about some of the things that he has done vis-a-vis labor that is part of his agenda to help the American worker. One of them was to expand eligibility for overtime pay. Can you talk about that? And talk about some of the other things that the Obama administration did from its perspective to help the American worker. And then once you're done with that, I'm going to ask you, and how likely would those things continue under a President Trump?
Sure. No question that the overtime regulation was one of the most ambitious labor regulations that they enacted. This raised the threshold below which people automatically get time and a half overtime pay after 40 hours a week from about $23,000 to just under $48,000. So really, made millions of people, salaried employees, this is salaried, not just hourly, newly eligible for overtime. That was slated to go in effect on December 1st. There was a coalition of state attorney generals and business groups who challenged that in federal court. Federal judge did slap an injunction on that regulation, so it is not currently in effect, pending the outcome of an appeal from the Labor Department. The one kind of wrinkle there is a lot of companies anticipated that going into effect, and many larger companies essentially changed their HR policies already. So even if that ends up cast aside either by a federal court or by the Trump administration, which I think people think is likely, if the courts don't do it, that the Trump Labor Department will. This actually will go into effect as a practical matter for a lot of people, just because many large employers have already made this adjustment. So that's kind of a signature policy. You know, there have been a variety of other things, many of them affecting federal contractors and employees of federal contractors, which obviously the administration has a lot of leverage over. One was to give paid sick leave, I think about 6 days of paid sick leave for employees of federal contractors. Another, which the contracting community called the blacklisting rule, which basically requires contractors to disclose labor violations of the variety that we were just discussing going back several years in order to even apply for a federal contract. So it basically requires contractors to have a kind of clean record on employment and labor violations if they want to receive a federal contract. So there were a number of regulations. Some of these went through a kind of formal rulemaking process, like the overtime rule, that was very, many months in the making. And if the courts were to leave that intact, the Trump administration would basically have to go through a similar months-long process to undo it. There were others, like some of these federal contractor directives, that were basically done through the pen, as the mm-hmm. president likes to say, and they could be easily undone through the pen too, you know, just days or hours into the Trump administration.
And now on expanded eligibility for overtime pay, sick leave, these contractor rules that were put in place by the Obama administration. Do we know where Labor Secretary designé Puzder is on those issues? I can't imagine that he's in favor of any of these.
Yeah, he's been very explicit about rejecting the overtime regulation, you know, suggesting, you know, a common argument that we heard when the administration solicited comments from the employer community on this was that it would lead to a kind of downgrading of status among employees, that you have a lot of salaried employees who now don't get overtime eligibility. And in order to sort of keep track of their hours, employers would just convert them to hourly employees, and they would just punch in and punch out, and they'd lose a lot of the flexibility that they enjoy as salaried workers. And Puzder has made a version of that argument, you know, that it would be a big kind of status hit, and we'd reclassify a lot of people, and a lot of workers would be unhappy. There was a lot of, you know, a big chorus from the employer community saying that workers would really hate this, which we often hear when these labor and employment regulations are enacted. So he's made that argument. You know, one of his biggest arguments actually had not to do with a regulation per se, but with Obamacare, with the Affordable Care Act, and his argument was actually not so much that this was creating new costs for employers, though he certainly raised that concern, but that because Obamacare was leading to rising premiums on the healthcare exchanges, workers had less money in their pockets and fewer people were eating out at fast food restaurants. So it was a somewhat novel argument.
A little bit of a self-serving argument.
Self-serving, yeah, a little bit of a bank shot. And there's just not a lot of evidence that was the case. For one thing, if you look at like the National Restaurant Association numbers, overall the restaurant industry is doing pretty well. I mean, some analysts have suggested that we're in a restaurant recession in the third quarter this year. Was definitely lighter than previous quarters, but kind of going forward, the projections look fine for the industry. And you know, beyond that, they just like if you parse the numbers really carefully and look at states where premiums have risen the most, you just don't see a lot of evidence for a big bite in demand. So it was a little, as you say, a little self-serving, and there wasn't a ton of evidence for that. But he, you know, I think what it suggests, to just step back, is that he is a person whose view of the economy, of workers, is really heavily, heavily informed by his experience running a company that oversees fast food restaurants. And, you know, I think there are some benefits to that, but just to kind of return to the earlier theme, one of the things that you care about most if you're running a kind of retail operation or a consumer-facing service operation is minimizing labor costs, right? I mean, mm-hmm. that's like a huge line item for you, and as a former Obama official told me in one of the stories I wrote about him, you know, a good day for you is really reining in labor costs if you're the CEO of such a company. And for the labor secretary, that's just not the case, right? I mean, you want prosperity and the kind of benefits of productivity to be as widely shared among workers as it can be. So certainly the idea that his experience would be shaped, his views of labor and the economy would be shaped by his experience as a CEO, suggests a different direction at the very least for how someone might run a labor department.
Well, yeah, a different direction. I'm sort of latching on to what you said earlier about the power of the labor department in terms of enforcement and at least message sending or signaling to employers, to the labor market about what the federal government is thinking about labor and workers. And it just seems that with this labor secretary nomination, as with a lot of other nominations made by President-elect Trump, that you basically have people who are sort of antithetical to the mission of that particular department running the department. And so are we looking at a situation where enforcement at the Labor Department is just going to sort of wither away?
Yeah, I think there's a real concern. I mean, I will say in his defense, in Puzder's defense, that there are, you can go on the Department of Labor's website and find, different employers and see how often that they have been investigated and complaints have been filed for either health and safety violations or wage and hour violations. And CKE, the company that he runs, which is the parent of Hardee's and Carl's Jr., if you look at the stores that the company owns directly rather than the ones that are franchised, they're not a ton of violations. So I think you want to be fair to him. He's not, certainly under the stores that were he was directly responsible for, these were not like egregious as far as the industry goes. I think, you want to be fair about that. Having said that, the fast food industry as a whole does not have a great reputation mm-hmm. for treating workers, humanely or in a super progressive way as far as kind of worker rights goes and just as far as kind of thinking of workers as kind of active participants in the running of stores and businesses. Mm-hmm. So I think, even if you're kind of, median or above average for the fast food industry, it's not a sector of the economy that's been historically, super great for workers. And so just having your kind of entire worldview informed by that experience, again, would be a different way of looking at your mandate as labor secretary.
Yeah, and one of those areas where the fast food industry is sort of central, that is the area of minimum wage. And I want to talk to you about that after we take this break. My guest is New York Times labor reporter Noam Scheiber, and we're talking about the nationwide fight for 15 for fast food workers, or at least we're going to after the break, and many others following the election of Donald Trump and the appointment of fast food magnate Andrew Puzder to his cabinet. We'll hear more from Noam after the break. Jonathan Capehart in today for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Noam Scheiber. He is a New York Times labor reporter, and we're talking about labor, the incoming Trump administration, and the fight for 15. And Noam, what is Labor Secretary designate Andrew Puzder's position on the minimum wage?
So he, again, you want to be fair to him. He has criticized the kind of substantial wage increases that both New York State and California now have enacted. He has said that he is for a quote unquote rational minimum wage increase, and has also said that he believes the goal of people who run companies like his should not be to have a lot of people working at minimum wage. So he argues that it should be very much a kind of entry level thing, and you very quickly want to promote people beyond that. So I'd say he's kind of carved out a place as a critic, but not kind of relentlessly ideological critic.
But I've got to ask what does it mean to rationally raise the minimum wage? Does he define that?
Yeah, it's a great question, and he's been a little bit in different places about this. There are times where he's been more kind of overtly critical. It's tough to decode every term. I would say that the way that a lot of economists think about this is in relationship to the median wage, and there is a lot of evidence suggesting that a minimum wage increase that is in the neighborhood of half, or a minimum wage that is in the neighborhood of half, or even slightly more than half of the median wage. If you take the worker in the absolute middle of the income distribution, and what they make, and if you take half of that and put the minimum wage there, there just aren't a ton of negative effects on employment. So I think there, in a lot of parts of the country, there's a lot of room to raise the minimum wage without having these bad employment effects. And would he say that's rational or not? I don't know. Mm-hmm. But But it, certainly the evidence suggests that there's a lot of room in a lot of places, and even a lot of places in California and New York. Now, the, you know, the flip side is, and I've written about this before, that there are some parts of California and some parts of New York, you know, where wages are very low. They're kind of rural and California inland areas, and it could be the case that under the current minimum wage law that, you know, phases into this $15 minimum wage over a series of years, that it does create, you know, create some hardship in a place like Stockton, California, or something. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are different ways to interpret what he says. Some of it would be, you know, overly skeptical, and you know, but if you're talking about Stockton, California, and a $15 minimum wage, then, you know, that's a plausible mm-hmm. argument to make.
You know, every time there's a suggestion or a call for a raising of the minimum wage, there is always the argument, usually from business owners and business leaders, saying, no, you can't do it. You mustn't do it because it will hurt the economy. People will be thrown off their jobs. It will have the opposite effect of what the proponents of raising the minimum wage would like to see. And yet I am always persuaded by the argument that when you raise the minimum wage, the people who get that minimum wage are going to spend that money immediately, and that ends up helping the economy. Who's right? The business leaders who are against it, or those of us like me who think raising the minimum wage is good for workers and good for the economy? Or are we both right?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to generalize completely, but there is certainly a lot of evidence for the view that you lay out. There's a guy named Michael Reich at Berkeley, at University of California, Berkeley, who's done a lot of empirical work on this, and he makes very much that point that you make, that once you factor in the kind of demand side effects, workers having more money and spending that money often at some of these same establishments, that you get more out of it than you put into it, essentially. Mm-hmm. So that's true. I mean, I think the question is always, you know, even someone like Professor Reich, who's on the you know, the kind of more you know, progressive, ambitious side of this minimum wage debate, would concede, as you know, he's had when we've talked about it, that there's some range over which that ceases to be true, right? Mm-hmm. So, and you know, we've seen in Europe, you know, countries getting up over kind of 60-65% of this median wage that I mentioned earlier, and still not seeing huge employment effects. So I think there's a good amount of evidence that there's a pretty large range over which we can raise the minimum wage. But it isn't infinite, right? I mean, right. The critics are right. There is clearly some point at which you start to encourage automation. There's also evidence. I think this is interesting because it's a conclusion that I think we're seeing come into focus, and it kind of borrows arguments from both sides, which is you can actually raise the minimum wage quite a bit and not get huge employment effects on net, right? Like no overall job losses, but you end up kind of replacing one kind of worker for another kind of worker. You know, you raise the minimum wage from 10 to 15, and suddenly, you know, a hardware store that had been paying its workers minimum wage or just above doesn't hire fewer workers, but they want just a much more knowledgeable kind of worker for that $15. And so you end up replacing one kind of worker with another. You don't see the result of that in the overall employment or unemployment numbers, but you do, you know, you're getting a different kind of worker who's actually benefiting from that paycheck.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the fight for 15. And right now there are 19 states that either voted to raise the minimum. Yeah, 19 states have voted to raise the minimum wage in 2017, right? And California is going to raise it to $10.50 an hour for businesses with 26 or more employees. New York is doing it, rising to $11 in New York, $10 in the suburbs, $9.70 elsewhere.
Thank you for providing those details. Yeah, I would have completely whiffed on them. So
that's what I'm here for.
Yeah.
To fill in the blanks. And in those numbers that I just read in terms of New York, that sort of gets to the example you were using about California and like a place like Stockton, where yeah. you know, a $15 an hour minimum wage could be harmful. But Let's talk about the fight for 15 and where it goes from here. It started, correct me if I'm wrong, with fast food workers, but they're looking to branch out, or they are branching out beyond fast food workers.
Yeah, no question. So the Fight for 15 is a very interesting movement. We're in kind of year five. It's been 4 years. I think that there are a couple of smart things that they've done. One is they just have understood from the very beginning that even if you have a sympathetic president and a sympathetic administration, Washington is probably not where most of the action on workers and wages is going to happen. And so they were very smart about kind of building their movement to fit an era where of gridlock in Washington, and also smart to understand that just because you don't have power in Washington doesn't mean you don't have political power. And so they were very sophisticated about raising this issue, about getting in the face of politicians in states where where there was a kind of there were levers that could be pulled, and New York was clearly one. I mean, at some point in 2015, they essentially were negotiating in public with Andrew Cuomo. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't like they were literally sitting across the table from one another, but it was basically as close as you could get to that and still be metaphorical. And eventually, they did get the $15 in New York. So they've been very good at finding opportunities to do this in states and cities. And I think the real question for them is how you broaden out from, progressive parts of the country, from urban areas. And I think what they're, I think that the strategy is to argue essentially that, there are 60 million people who don't make $15 an hour. A lot of those are white working class people who voted for Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And I think if you look at the big protest they did in November, a couple weeks after the election, a lot of that was sort of attempting to signal this expansion. And, they made airports and airport workers the focus of that day of protest. And the message surrounding airports was, a generation ago, these were jobs that you could support a family on. You were a baggage handler, or you were someone who pushed people in a wheelchair to get on a plane. These were jobs that the airlines themselves, supported. They hired the workers in-house, and they paid them, decent wages and decent benefits. Over the course of the past generation, these have all been outsourced. Often there are 2, 3, 4 degrees between the airlines and the actual employer of the workers. And in that lengthening of the chain, the wages have stagnated, the benefits have disappeared. And so the argument was, in a way, that the jobs that Donald Trump is talking about and the workers that Donald Trump is talking to, a lot of those people are our people. They're doing jobs that a generation ago would have been jobs that they could support their family on, and those are no longer those kinds of jobs. And those are the people they're trying to reach now. And we'll see. I think there's a very compelling case to be made. As you point out, there's a number of states, Arizona was one of them, where the minimum wage was raised, and they were Trump states. So there's clearly a kind of demographic of Trump voter, of white working class worker that is going to be receptive to some of this message.
Mm-hmm. And also the Fight for 15 is, I believe, trying to loop in unprotected workers in the so-called gig economy, like Uber drivers and the like, correct?
Correct. Yeah, this was the first time. There had been kind of related efforts to organize Uber drivers, and we've seen those kind of wax and wane over the course of the past 2 years. But this was the first time where the actual Fight for 15 movement pulled them in. And we'll see. I mean, I think from where they sit, it's clear that they have had a dramatic effect on the sector where they started. And the question is kind of how far they can expand through the economy, because there are these 60 million workers. Mm-hmm. So it's a huge constituency. And so far, it does look like they've been able to pull in other sectors, the Uber drivers being the latest mm-hmm. to join. So I think you know, they realize they have to broaden this thing out. I think one of the other things to keep in mind on this is these things have a kind of domino effect. I was talking to an official at SEIU, which is the union, the service workers mm-hmm. union, that's really invested a ton of money in this, you know, tens of millions of dollars in this Fight for 15 movement. And the question always arises with SEIU is, what kind of return has this union gotten on this multi-million dollar investment since they haven't actually organized a single new member as a result of this? And a lot of what they say is, look, you know, this is super helpful for workers everywhere. If you have a bunch of hospital workers, right, and the fast food workers in that city have just gotten an increase from $10 to $15 an hour, then the hospital workers, when they sit across the bargaining table from management of the hospital, say, look, McDonald's is now paying people $15 an hour. Like, we're not going to settle for anything less than that, even right. if, you know, there's no minimum wage, there's nothing forcing the hospital to raise that wage. It's an increase in leverage. And mm-hmm. so I think this does ripple through the economy, and they're right to point that out.
Yeah. No, I got to ask you something before we have to go in a few minutes. And that is, well, President-elect Trump, when he was running, he promised to bring manufacturing and factory jobs back to the American economy and to put those workers, those folks back to work. But there are a lot of economists who say that the biggest threat to those jobs, that have been lost either to trade or offshoring or immigration or whatever, it's not those things, it's automation. And one of the things that Andrew Puzder, the labor secretary designee, said in an interview with Business Insider last March, where he was praising robot employees, he said, quote, "They're always polite. They always upsell. They never take a vacation. They never show up late. There's never a slip and fall or an age, sex, or race discrimination case." This from the person who is going to be the head of the Labor Department.
Right. Tell us how you feel. Really feel, right? Look. I think you're right on both points. Clearly, automation is a force where the genie's kind of out of the bottle, it's tough to turn back the clock on a fair amount of this. I will say, just on Trump and whether, you know, to what extent he's swimming upstream with this, I am. Not someone who thinks that these efforts are completely useless. You know, I think mm-hmm. there has been this kind of this belief that a lot of the manufacturing offshoring is inevitable, and some of it is. A lot of it might be, but we do lose something when we lose manufacturing jobs. We lose know-how. We lose, you know, just good jobs for workers that may otherwise mm-hmm. be working at a Gap or a McDonald's. So I don't think these efforts are completely in vain. I think there may be some signaling that happens and norm changing. That's important.
Great. Thanks a lot, Noam Shriver. I've been speaking with Noam Shriver, the New York Times labor reporter, and we've been talking about the nationwide Fight for 15 for fast food workers and many others following the election of Donald Trump. Noam, thanks so much for joining us today.
Enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.